Welcome back to the program. Like it or not, we are in the midst of political season, where once Labor Day was the official start of our national political drama, today it seems to be a multi-year, multi-dimensional business, one in which presumably ordinary men and women need to acquire the mixture of ambition, stamina, and shamelessness that it takes to be a successful candidate. It was Adlai Stevenson who said that the hardest thing about political campaigns is how to win without proving that you're unworthy of winning. Boy, is that true today. We're going to talk about what it takes to win and hold the White House with one of our nation's most astute political observers and political scientists. He's Samuel Popkin. He's a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's been a consulting analyst in numerous presidential campaigns, serving as a consultant to the Clinton campaign, to CBS News. He's also served as a political consultant to parties in Canada and Europe. It is my pleasure to welcome Samuel Popkin to this program to talk about his book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Samuel Popkin, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, I'm pleased to be here, and I wish I had remembered the Stevenson quote for my book, because that gets to the heart of the problem.
And it does get to the heart of the problem. And is that problem a bigger problem today, in which there is so much exposure, so much news, so much out there, than it was, say, 60 years ago, some of the earlier campaigns of the modern era that you look at in The Candidate?
Well, whether it's a bigger problem or an advantage depends on whether you're Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, Paul Tsongas on one hand, or Bill Clinton and some of the winners on the other. I like, despite the absurdity of what it looks like much of the time, I like the fact that the candidates have to be screened in public and not in a smoke-filled room. And despite all the problems we have, I think we're better off today than when a few guys in a smoke-filled room decided who their delegates would vote for.
Better off in terms of the political process or the governing results, and those aren't always the same.
I agree. Nobody feels good about how this goes on in public, but Eugene McCarthy spent 8 years trying to look like the man who reluctantly entered the race in 1968. People have always campaigned forever if they wanted to be president, but now they have to campaign more openly, and I think more of the flaws get exposed, but even more important, you have to work with a lot of very smart people and learn something about handling the foreign policy people. You have to learn how to handle the economists. It's not perfect, but it's better, I think, than it was.
And that was one of, going back into very recent time, it was one of the things that was talked about a lot during the Obama campaign 3.5 years ago, that the effectiveness of the campaign, that the way it was run, that its efficiency was somehow emblematic of good management and spoke well for the candidate.
It is management, but it's not ever going to be the case that managing a challenger's campaign is as easy as managing a government or an incumbent's campaign. It's just a better prep. Like, spring training is never going to be the baseball season. Football exhibition games are never going to be the NFL, but they're better than just warming up on your own.
And then the other models that you talk about is the difference between running an incumbency campaign for president versus a challenger campaign, not unlike the difference between running General Electric versus running a startup.
You're right, and I was really struck by that the minute I looked back at the campaigns from 1960 until today. Everybody is saying, can Obama do what he did in 2008? Of course not. And if they try, they're guaranteed to fail badly. An incumbent is a battleship, and it moves very slowly, but it makes very big waves. And a challenger is more like a torpedo boat who zips along and can adapt very quickly, but smaller waves.
Right. Historically, have we seen incumbents that have tried to run a challenger's campaign and succeeded at all, or failed miserably, as the case may be?
Jimmy Carter, 1980, mm-hmm. tried to fall back on the folksy style and the personal character. You can trust me, so I can do it all. When you're president, your character really isn't the issue any longer. It's your results. And especially when you've had mixed results, how do you prove that that half-full glass would have been empty without you, or would have been at least less full? When every challenger says, you overpromised, and I can fill the glass.
Of course, the other side of that is that if you can't argue results, then you attack the character of the guy you're running against.
Yes, and character does matter more in a challenger, because we don't really have their record in front of us as president. And so we're basing a lot of how we feel about them both on their party and on their claims of being a Boy Scout, a general, a CEO, a good Christian, a community leader. And so we want to know, are they really, does it fit?
Talk a little bit about that and the difference between what we see in campaigns where it's a challenger versus an incumbent, as opposed to a non-incumbent race as we had 3.5 years ago.
Yeah, the non-incumbent is very difficult. But for the, let's get back to this one. Mitt Romney is an outsider in that he's never been a senator or a congressman. So he can say, I will fix things. My skills are the obvious answer, that everything wrong in Washington is that we have a bad president from the wrong party. And Obama can't get things done because he doesn't understand the wisdom of Bain Capital. And Obama's big attacks started out to be, well, what is the wisdom of Bain Capital and how does it really fit the problems of the country? And his hope is that as president, the things he does on foreign policy will make us feel like, well, he killed bin Laden, he's getting us out of the wars, could Mitt do that? It's really his results versus Mitt's promise.
Is it different today because we have shorter attention spans, because we're always looking, certainly more aggressively now, for the new thing? How does that change the dynamic?
Well, to my amazement, and I can't explain why, people today talk more about issues than before Twitter, Facebook, cable news. I mean, back in the days of the evening news that half the people watched and it was very conventional and less gossip, people paid less attention to everything. And I think we've learned in some way to sort out what matters and what's fun to talk about. I mean, it was much more fun to joke about Bill Clinton and his eating habits or Monica than it was to talk about the problems of taxes. But I think when people voted, they knew the difference.
Sort of reminds me of another Stevenson quote, actually. I think it was in the 56 campaign, and somebody shouted out to him in an event that you have the vote of every thinking person. And Stevenson's response was, I'm sorry, ma'am, that's not enough. I need a majority.
Exactly. And, you know, after every election, the Democrats will all agree, yeah, the people didn't know, the press didn't tell the people the right facts. And the Republicans will agree, yeah, the press avoided the real facts. But they'll disagree on what the real facts were. I mean, it's not like there's an obvious thing people are supposed to know, even though the Obama campaign is certain they know what people should understand, and so is the Romney campaign.
Of course, the other part of it is, as you talk about in the candidate, is that it's very easy to sort of lay out a strategy and a plan until you get in the real world, until you get in the ring.
Yeah, and, you know, it's very hard right now to know if the Obama campaign has a chessboard in their mind and they're playing it carefully or they're lurching, because we haven't seen the second move on the attacks on Romney, and we haven't seen how Romney comes back and whether the Obama campaign has planned the next attack. Remember when Bill Walsh was in charge of the 49ers, he always had 15 plays he ran to see what the other team did, and then he would figure out what he was going to get away with. Well, they're feinting each other out, and it's very difficult to think ahead when you're president. You know, Obama couldn't control Arne Duncan from saying "Yes, I do" on gay marriage. You can't fire the vice president if he talks too soon. You just don't have the same control anymore.
It's a little like getting into the boxing ring, and you don't know where that next punch is coming from.
You know, my favorite quote when I was writing the book was somebody talking about the world according to Mike Tyson. When they asked him about his fights, and he said, everybody has a strategy until they get hit in the face. And that's where your coordination and your ability to work with other people really matters. You can't possibly be ready for a Twin Towers or a bank crash, but you need somebody you know well enough so that when you listen to them, you can get it fast. I mean, imagine you're on an airplane, and the airplane lands, and you get a call that says, there's a mushroom cloud over X. That could be one of 50 cities. And there's 200 reporters waiting at the bottom of the stairs. If you've really worked with your team, they can say, you've got the UN option, the we're going to wait till we hear more option, or our heart goes out. You can have, but it's got to be very short and fast. And if you just, like John McCain in 2008, where you haven't yet learned any economics or listened to those brilliant advisors you've got in the room with you from Stanford, you're dead. And he looked like he was out of touch.
And McCain is a good example of a strategy or a strategic move that backfired when he said, you know, I'm going to suspend my campaign. I mean, that didn't work out too well.
That was his desperate move. It would have been a game-changing winner for him if he had ever listened in the last 8 years to his economists and done his homework. You know, that sort of amplifies the fact that you can't just have a lot of money and hire a lot of wizards and have a good campaign. The bigger the campaign gets, the more you have to be on top of it as the candidate and build a team.
How important is it within this framework to be really clear about what the narrative is of the candidate and the campaign, and the degree to which both attacks and affirmative statements need to fit within that narrative in order to be authentic?
You raised the toughest word there is for candidates, authentic. Everybody who is watching, every voter wants to believe that the person is real. And yet, what you're doing is looking real to all sorts of people as opposed to being real. And it's extremely difficult to be yourself publicly when really you're only yourself sometime alone. And it's extraordinarily hard to know. You have to know who you are, number one. But number two, you have to have people around you who know who you are so that they can remind you that what looks like an obvious part of what you've always said in a new audience isn't some incredibly dangerous statement that you haven't thought about.
All of this all has to fit into the nature of anybody that would run for president. And that sets up a whole set of circumstances unto itself, because the very business of saying that you're running for president requires a very unique kind of person.
Mo Udall once said that when you say you're running for president and you walk in a room, it reminded him of the old westerns where the new marshal walks into the saloon, or the new Billy the Kid or somebody walks in the saloon, and everybody looks at him and says, is he really the fastest gun? There's a sense of, who do you think you are that you think you're the best in the world? And if you've got the audacity to say you are ready to be the most powerful person in the world, how do you sit down with somebody when you get off the stage and say, okay, I don't know anything about Rwanda. What is it all about? Or explain to me what a credit default swap is, or something that you haven't ever dealt with as a governor or a senator.
I mean, not unlike the end of the movie, The Candidate, where they turn to each other and say, you know, the candidate says, what do I do now?
Exactly. There are, in real life, there are always going to be moments like that. I mean, did anything prepare John Kennedy for the Cuban Missile Crisis? You know, there are always those moments, and that's when the resources you've developed between people so that you know whether the calm person who raises their voice a tiny bit really, this is serious, or the person who's always shouting and so it doesn't mean anything. You have to know the people.
And that goes to the heart of the character issue that you talked about before, because you can't effectively know every issue. The candidate can't, the public can't, so that it does come down to character and your belief in how that person will react under those circumstances.
Yes, and that's, you hit it exactly, and that's why it's not just how smart the candidate is or what their grades or their SRTs are. That old line about Roosevelt had a second-rate intellect and a first-rate character, that's really important, because no president is ever should be the smartest person on anything going on. It'd be a waste of their time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's 100 issues he's going to deal with in a day, or she's going to deal with. If you're the world's expert on that issue, you've been putting too much time on one of the 100 and not enough learning the people you've got to deal with, or schmoozing the senators who are critical.
Is the way we vote for president different than the way we vote for any other political office? Is it more of a gut check kind of vote?
Yes, and it's also a stranger combination of fantasy and reality, because the president is sometimes about hopes and dreams, and sometimes the president is about just getting us through the war or getting us out of Korea. And that's why I labeled the chapter of the candidate about challengers, the search for an experienced virgin. You want somebody who's pure, who never compromises, who's authentic, and yet you want somebody who can handle all the dirty in the swamp.
How much is our view of politics and the presidency specifically been shaped by, certainly in the past 40, 50, 60 years, been shaped by the media, by the nexus between news and entertainment, and what impact has that had on the process and the way in which campaigns are conducted today?
It spread the field in two different ways. Number one, it's made it a lot easier for one-note candidates to get a start. Somebody like Michelle Bachmann, as Ed Rollins complained when she never did her homework, can go on Fox News, say something truly outrageous, and raise a couple million dollars fast, but never get beyond that to do more, but in the process make it really hard on anybody who wants to be a moderate, because they keep being nibbled at from the right or the left. But it also makes it, spreads the field on more issues get raised, because you can be very deep on an issue on a financial show for people who understand the depths of a technology issue, or say the issues of online privacy, and then you have to go on Oprah or a big morning show and have an answer that doesn't contradict it that you can give to people who know less about it.
Does the amount of money being spent today make that big a difference? Does it change the playing field?
I have to tell you, if I could answer that question, I'd feel like a Nobel laureate. What I see is a lot of similarities to an arms race. Did it matter when we and the Russians each had 8,000 nukes as opposed to 800? I don't really think so. But you keep doing it on the grounds that they're doing it. And right now, I think you're seeing something very destructive happen for the first time, which is all these competing super PACs, where a lot of these consultants are out to make a name for themselves, whether it helps or hurts the party or the candidate. I think the people who cheered this on the right are going to wish it had never happened before this is over.
It's interesting you bring that up, because one of the things you talk about that's changed dramatically in modern politics is the disconnect between the party and the candidate.
Yes, that's, to my mind, that's what the biggest thing about the modern campaign is. is, and it started with Teddy Roosevelt, where the president became an actor, not just a rubber stamp for the Congress. In the old days, you pick a war hero, you put him on the porch, and you say, we're a party and a war hero. Now the candidates have autonomy, and there's always a conflict between what's good for the president and what's good for the congressman. And we're going to see a lot of this tension because the Republicans control Congress in the compromises Mitt Romney makes to support or be close to Paul Ryan aren't necessarily the statements he would have wished that he would have made if, say, the Democrats controlled Congress.
That's one of the downsides, arguably, of taking it out of the smoke-filled room and the proliferation of the primary process, is that what candidates, and this is true on both sides, what candidates have to say in order to win the nomination is not necessarily what they need to be saying in order to win the election.
Well, yes and no. You're certainly right that Mitt Romney wishes he didn't have to say some of these things. But if you want, when he gets to Washington, he has to deal with his party's Congress, and the voters might as well learn about that now as later and be surprised. When Eisenhower got elected, his big complaint was the Republicans don't seem to understand that they're in the White House, too.
It goes back to a time when party platforms mattered, when there was, as you say, kind of a set of rules or a set of ideas that the party stood for, and the candidate became the embodiment of that, and that's certainly not true anymore.
Well, it's always been a tension between the candidate gets a platform, but the job... If Romney has control of the convention, the platform will be a very moderate New England border states platform. But then the Obama administration has to find a way to get Romney to prove that Paul Ryan, Congressman Ryan and the Budget Committee and his party will actually go along with that. It's only a platform that matters if you can deliver on it. And Truman's victory over Dewey was not fiery speeches, but proving that Dewey's party wouldn't support him in Washington.
Talk about that campaign, because 48 was really a pretty interesting model in which to draw some conclusions, perhaps, about the current campaign.
Thank you for asking, because what really convinced me to write this book was spending time in the Dewey archives. You know, the popular image is the fiery Truman and the stiff Dewey, that Dewey was somehow an earlier Mike Dukakis who didn't know what to do, like a deer in the headlight. But Dewey was actually dashing, dynamic, popular, even brilliant at times, and he was paralyzed by the fact that his party in the Senate and Congress refused to go along with his popular platform, and Truman proved it in the campaign.
But they also were effective. It's interesting when you talk about him being stiff. I mean, they did a good job of painting him as the guy on top of the wedding cake.
But that's because he couldn't say anything without Taft saying, you're wrong. He couldn't talk about what Truman submitted basically Dewey's program to the Republican Senate and Congress, and the Republican Senate and Congress ignored it. And that made it hard for Dewey to claim, if you elect me, this is what you'll get.
What should Obama learn from that campaign?
Well, you learn the same thing Bill Clinton learned in 96 when George Stephanopoulos wrote that Newt Gingrich and the freshmen became the White House's best friends. You've got to find a way to show people that Mitt Romney is a Republican, not just a wonderful businessman from outside who knows more about job creation than a, quote, European-styled faculty intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
European-styled is what Romney says.
As if European, I mean, even before the current financial crisis, had this evil sound to it.
Yes, I think that's the polite way of saying he's really not like us. And it's always been something that can be raised when you're African American, or when you grow up in Hawaii, or when your middle name is Hussein, or when you lived in Indonesia as a child.
To what extent does the horse race aspect of this, the fact that there is now constant polling, constant numbers that come out, to what extent does that shape and impact the race, do you think?
I think the big thing is it gives everybody heartaches and ulcers, because every time there's a bad poll, you know, 99 polls might come out saying the race was within a point and a half. One poll comes out that says it's 3 points, which is no big deal, and everybody calls the candidate or the pollsters or the strategist, what happened, what happened, what happened? And thank God today there are websites like 538.com that are applying statistical sanity, so it's not quite as bad as it used to be.
What it also requires, I mean, to sort of bring it around to the character issue and where we started this, it requires on the part of the candidate today, because of all of this noise machine, an even greater amount of discipline than it did previously.
Yes, and preparation. You have to have so much more knowledge today. You know, John Kennedy ghosted a book with Theodore Sorensen to show he had intellectual credentials. And he was clever and smart, but he traveled the country with three people. Before George W. Bush could run for president, Condi Rice spent a year tutoring him. He met once a week with the economists. He met once a week with the defense people. That's a new world. You have to do a lot of preparation. Being a governor or a senator isn't enough. And I think that makes it you closer to the job. That certainly doesn't guarantee success.
Samuel Popkin, the book is The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Sam, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, I look forward to talking with you after the conventions in the fall.